This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Coming up, it's Veterans Day, and we'll learn about the World War II exhibit at the Veterans Memorial Building in San Luis Obispo.
The European theater got most of the publicity, and yet the whole island-hopping campaign was just unbelievable, and the casualty rates were tremendous.
Also, November is Senior Pet Month.
We love the idea of senior folks and senior pets. They have similar energy levels. They both still need to be active. They both still need to be on a routine. It's great companionship.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, November 11th, Veterans Day 2024. I'm Carol Tangeman. The movie Sideways is 20 years old, and there's a new book out, Sideways, Uncorked, a perfect pairing of film and wine. We have the authors here, Kirk Honeycutt and Mira Advani Honeycutt. Thank you both for being here.
You're welcome.
Thank you for having us.
So just briefly, what are your backgrounds? We'll start with you, Kirk.
Well, I was a film journalist for much of my life, including both reporting, feature writing, and film criticism, and I kind of were interspersed over many, many years. But at the time that Sideways did come out, I was the chief film critic of the Hollywood Reporter, running the department and reviewing major films, and we reviewed this one out of the Toronto International Film Festival. So that's where I first saw Sideways 20 years ago.
Okay. And how about you, Mira?
Well, I've been doing journalism for many years, I would say about 25-some years. Early on, I did a lot of what I call lifestyle journalism. So it was film, fashion, art, architecture, food and wine, travel. I mean, everything, mostly on California style for international publications. And then I think over the last 15-some years, it's just kind of focused on wine. Mm. And mostly California wine, so I contribute to several publications within in Paso, in Central Coast, and nationally, a couple of publications called the Tasting Panels and the Somme Journal, and then a magazine out of India called Sommelier India Wine Magazine. So it's pretty much focused on wine right now, and some food, some travel, but pretty much wine.
Okay, so this really is, for the two of you, the perfect pairing of film and wine.
Yes.
And let's start with the movie Sideways. If someone hasn't seen it, what would be a short description? You know, a couple of sentences.
Ooh, down to the elevator pitch.
Yeah.
Two aging but irresponsible men go off to wine tasting before the marriage of one for a week and get into all kinds of trouble, some romantic, some more physical. And it's a comedy, but like all of Alexander Payne's movies, he's the director and co-writer, it has a serious undertone.
Yeah.
So we can talk about that.
Yeah. So what drew you to the project, aside from the obvious fact that, Mira, you write about wine, and Kirk, you are a film guy. What brought you to this?
Well, that wasn't the original impetus that we would do this together.
Right.
I just decided it was something that we should do together. In fact, this is probably the only book we could combine those two areas of interest in our journalistic careers, film and wine. It was her idea for me to write a book, and it happened when we were at a big wine function down in Santa Barbara County, which was the warehouse winery that sits in Bienvenido Vineyard that was the late Jim Clendenin and Bob Lindquist and Frank Ostini and a lot of people used as their headquarters. We were at a big, major open house. They do it once a year. And it was very clearly that it was a very Sideways-influenced event, even though the movie wasn't mentioned anywhere. It was just all these people had been brought together and were drinking Pinot Noirs that had been featured in the movie and maybe had discovered this event and these people through that movie. And Mira said, there's a book in there. And so it went from there. I pitched it to an agent, and then we had to find some publisher who would understand it, which isn't so easy because the wine guy says, why you got all this movie stuff in here? And a movie acquiring editor would say, yeah, but what's all this stuff about wine? So it was just something we had to pitch to the right publication. Fortunately, we found one with Applause Books.
Okay.
They didn't know how to position the book, and I can understand, because they're like, do we put it on a film bookshelf? Do we put it on a wine bookshelf in the
store?
You
put it on both.
How about both, you know?
Right, or even just, I could see it as well on tourism, on California,
yes.
This is all kinds of places.
I was traveling earlier this year and at the LAX, and I didn't know there was a book soup shop at the airport. You know, book soup stores.
Yeah.
They're owned by Romans now.
Absolutely.
And I'm like, this is a place our book should be. It's a good travel book.
It's a good travel book for someone visiting an area, someone coming from an area, taking it with them.
Right, to
highlight our area. Now, you mentioned a phrase, the sideways effect. What is the sideways effect?
It was a phrase that journalists started using. I don't know who claims to coined the phrase, but journalists started using it, mostly wine journalists, because it was, in their way of thinking, the effect the movie had on the wine business, and that's certainly one of the major themes in our book. However, there was a sideways effect on the Santa Barbara wine country, which was pretty much unknown. We knew it. We even got married there long before this movie. But a lot of people just, they think California wine, they think Napa and maybe Sonoma, and then that's where the knowledge drops away. Santa Barbara suddenly was inundated with tourists, and that's not just wine tasting rooms. It was hotels, motels. It was all kinds of tourist activity and limos coming up from L.A. To escort some of the hoi polloi from Los Angeles. Sometimes not even as welcoming as they wanted to be. They sometimes the locals didn't like it as much.
Yeah.
The wine people did, but certainly restaurateurs were caught flat-footed. They just didn't realize they were going to bring on so many more employees and so many more personnel just to handle it all.
Yeah, so that's a mixed blessing.
The effect was on Santa Barbara. The effect was on the wine business. The effect was on all of California and somewhat Oregon in terms of Pinot Noir.
Right.
So that is the major thing. Pinot Noir, which was a grape that people didn't really know or understand 20 years ago, is suddenly now the number two or three wine on most wine lists. You go to a restaurant, and it's certainly very highlighted in all wine stores or even liquor stores. And the effect is on many aspects. And also, this wasn't part of the phrase, but the movie had a major impact on the American independent cinema, because this was like the film that got Fox Searchlight Pictures, who produced and distributed the film. They'd been around for 10 years and had some success, like The Full Monty, but they hadn't had this breakout hit that identified the new people that were now running the company. This was the kind of film they wanted to make. And it was their first film ever to be nominated for a Best Picture. And it did win one Oscar for the screenplay. And it won all the Spirit Awards, which is the awards for independent cinemas. And it made sense that the independent cinema had arrived. And so that was a sideways effect that the wine journalists weren't talking about, but we do in our book. It's the effect on all these things.
Yeah, yeah. If you're just joining us, this is KCBX Public Radio with Issues and Ideas. I'm Carol Tangeman, and with me today, authors Kirk Honeycutt and Mira Advani Honeycutt. We're talking about the book they wrote. It's the 20th anniversary of the movie Sideways, and their book is called Sideways Uncorked, The Perfect Pairing of Film and Wine. For those of us who live locally, had been drinking wine this way for a long time.
Casually,
this person making wine.
You were introduced to wine culture much
Yes,
more.
Before, because I'd lived here for a long time.
Right.
And so the movie Sideways came out, and a friend just said, okay, I'm going back to see this movie again. You will not believe this movie. Going into the theater, a lot of people had the same experience, just laughing and feeling this great sense of, oh my gosh, I have never seen anything quite like this. You could tell it was, you know, kind of low budget, but it just, spoke to us locally. Obviously, it spoke to a lot of people who weren't locals as well.
Yes, but see, that's when we were talking to Alexander, the director, on our Zoom chats, interviews. It's like, what is the effect that it touched so many people?
Yeah.
He says, I'm still scratching my head. What made this, what made this longevity to this movie? 20 years.
Well, what he did was, and I don't think they anticipated it, but he picked up a novel, an unpublished novel with the same name, Sideways, by Rex Pickett. And he saw a film immediately, but he saw it from his Omaha, Nebraska point of view. In fact, at that point, he had made three major films, and they were shot out of Nebraska. This was the first film he ever shot out of Nebraska.
Oh.
And so he's in the bucolic California wine country. And his films are kind of, I wouldn't want to say gritty, but they're kind of based in a kind of a reality. And so suddenly here he was with all this pretty landscapes, and it was almost too pretty for him, in fact.
Yeah.
But he didn't see what it became, which is a film that introduced people to wine, because you have one character is a wine geek and the other knows nothing about it.
Choose bubble
and
gum.
So he's explaining it to him all the way
tasting,
through.
Right.
Yeah, he's explaining it to him and telling him he shouldn't be chewing gum when you're tasting wine. So people suddenly said, oh, I didn't know about this thing about looking at the wine in the glass and sniffing it and nosing it and all this stuff. So it took some of the snobbery away, and it made it for everyday people.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it was like, this is something that's fun. It's not something that you have to be worried about mispronouncing the name of Gewürztraminer, say.
Yeah, right. Mm. Yeah, it's like, oh, you don't order that on a menu because you're embarrassed because you don't know how to pronounce it correctly, maybe.
Right.
Well,
right.
It's true. I don't know how to pronounce certain things, especially when you get into Italian grapes. And so I just say to the waiter, I don't know what this is, but what is it? I don't pretend I know these things, but most Americans are a little afraid of that. So this was why Merlot was such a big hit with Americans, because they can pronounce it.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And Cabernet, and I don't know, Pinot Noir, what is that? And there's one line in the film that a few days ago, Miles says about Jack, he didn't know Pinot Noir from film noir.
Yes.
There were some great lines in this movie.
There's some wonderful.
Yes.
There
yeah,
were some great
yeah.
lines. And I want to just stick with the wine for just a minute before I want to, you know, hear about cast members and the making of the movie, because that's fun too. As far as the wine, Pinot Noir and Merlot, what I found really interesting in the book was the research on the two wines, going back pretty far into the history of our local wine industry,
right,
and how it has changed because of this movie. Pinot Noir was put up on a pedestal. This was like a love story to Pinot Noir. And then Miles had that one comment about Merlot.
I know. Even the director, he says, I had no idea that one line will bring a whole industry down. Not a clue.
Well, the Merlot industry.
The Merlot industry, yeah. You know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think Merlot is getting some recognition now in the last several years. It's coming back and getting some respect. But you know, Pinot Noir was produced in Santa Barbara County, Santa Rita Hills, and at that time, Santa Rita Hills was not an appellation when the film was made, but Santa Maria Valley. Here in Edna Valley, Pinot Noir has always been, you know, the prime grape and Chardonnay, but a lot of locals knew about it because you say, you know, this is what you drink here. Up in Paso Robles, there was no Pinot Noir because of the climate.
Yeah.
It's too warm, you know. Mm-hmm. So people more used to Cabernet and Syrah and other Rhones.
And Zinfandel.
And Zinfandel, the heritage grape of Paso.
Wanted to be a Zinfandel region for the longest time.
Yes.
And then the Rhone Rangers came and says, no, it's Rhone Valley. And then everybody keeps tapping people on the shoulder and say, oh, by the way, the number one grape here planted is Cabernet.
Cabernet Brigade, I call it.
But there's little pockets of Pinot.
Of Pinot, very little.
It isn't the place you go for Pinot. It really isn't.
And at the time, you know, Merlot was kind of getting kind of a reputation of being a mediocre wine.
Sideways can be credited with improving it.
For better Merlot.
Many winemakers says it helped the grape because it got rid of the people that were making lousy versions of it.
Yeah.
And the best versions of it are some of the most expensive wines in the world.
Right,
it isn't that Miles doesn't like Merlot. He doesn't like the version of Merlot that was being served in restaurants and in wine tasting rooms.
It was the most popular by the glass wine in America at bars and restaurants, you know, by the glass program.
Yeah.
It was affordable and it was approachable in its taste.
Yeah.
So people who just wanted a glass of red wine, they just say red wine, and they would get Merlot. Yeah. You know, so it just.
So right after the movie, then that just.
Yeah, that
changed.
Just tanked.
Oh, it came off those wine by the glass lists very quickly.
Yeah, it just tanked. But again, good Merlot producers in Napa, let's say, you know, like Trefeth and Paul Meyer, Doug Horn, they said it didn't hurt us at all because Napa has good Merlots and they're expensive and they're made in the style that they should be made, grown the way they should be grown. So very small part of Merlot producers did not get hurt. Of course, it gave rise to Pinot, and suddenly people discovered a whole new variety. And then there were some people who loved big red wines, you know, Cabernet and Syrah. And to them, Pinot was like, what is this? It's light in color. It's light in flavor. So there's just a very small percentage. But by and large, people got introduced to Pinot Noir, you know.
Right. If you're just joining us, this is KCBX Public Radio with Issues and Ideas. I'm Carol Tangeman, and with me today, authors Kirk Honeycutt and Mira Advani Honeycutt. We're talking about the book they wrote. It's the 20th anniversary of the movie Sideways, and their book is called Sideways Uncorked, The Perfect Pairing of Film and Wine. We all remember the quote, Miles' quote, about Merlot.
Yes.
And if either of you want to, Kirk, go ahead and give us the quote without the expletive.
Miles and Jack, our two characters, are about to go into Los Olivos Cafe for a lovely romantic dinner with two wonderful women. Jack is making sure he's supposed to be getting married, but he wants to have his fun before the wedding. And so he wants to make sure the dinner goes as he sees it going. And Miles has meanwhile just learned that his ex-wife has been remarried and he's gone to the dark side, or is about to go to the dark side. So Jack is trying to tell him, look, you got to stop, don't drink too much, don't go to the dark side, and you know, even if they want to order Merlot, we'll drink Merlot. And he says, no, Miles said, I will leave if they do. I am not drinking any effing Merlot. That line got a huge laugh. And I laughed very hard because
laughed.
I had really despaired of the Merlot I was drinking, and it was one I always said, oh, it's a good blending grape, but I don't want to drink a varietal just as a single varietal. And so I knew exactly what he meant, but I didn't think anybody else thought the way I did, so it just really hit me. But then I realized everybody else was laughing too, so it's like it's one of those lines of recognition that when the director and his co-writer Alexander Payne and Jim Taylor came up with that line, which a version of that had been in the original novel. They had no sense that it'd be anything more than a funny joke.
Yes,
and it is still bewildering to him that he destroyed, as he says, the Merlot Empire.
Yeah.
Bewildering is right. And it's continued for years.
It has. If you're in a restaurant and someone orders a Merlot, somebody at the table is going to say it.
Funny. Right, but remember the key wine in the movie, and Alexander would point this out to you, is the one at the very end. Miles has ditched a wedding and gone back to San Diego and fetched a bottle of 1961 Cheval Blanc.
He'd been saving that, I remember.
Which he's
that.
Been saving, mm-hmm. And he's been told, well, any day you would open up that bottle, it's a special occasion. So he has it by himself in a burger joint, which drives wine people crazy because they say you never have a bottle like that by yourself, but he does.
Yeah.
That wine is mostly Merlot.
Oh.
And so Alexander was savvy enough to know he doesn't dislike Merlot. He just dislikes bad Merlot. And this is the best Merlot in the world.
And so
he is having a bottle of Merlot, which there's probably a little Cab Franc in there. And by the way, he disparages Cab Franc in the movie, too, where we meet the Sandra Oh character, and she pours a Cab Franc and says, it's pretty new. We just started bottling it.
Yeah.
And he says, well, I've never thought of them as being very good, and this certainly isn't. It's not transcendent. That's the way he speaks. It's not transcendent.
Okay, let's talk about the movie a little more. Your book explores a lot of what happened before the film finally came to the screen. There was a lot of back and forth with scripts and people saying yes and then saying no.
Well, we should first give Rex Pickett credit here because he's the one who came up with the story. It was based kind of on his very miserable life at the time. Marriage had dissolved. His film career, he was trying to make films independent, just like Alexander Payne. He had made two, almost on credit cards and his wife's trust fund and things like that. And that had disappeared because the films had not succeeded in any measurable way. And he was broke and living in rent-controlled Santa Monica apartment with roommates he couldn't stand. And he was escaping by playing golf up in the Santa Barbara area at La Parisima Golf Course. And only there did he discover, oh, this is wine country. And he was just getting into wine. So even though he's going through all this angst, he discovered wine, and he had a problem with alcohol. And this was a way he could investigate a new form of alcohol, and he would go up there with a buddy, and they would drink themselves silly and get into some trouble. And so he invented a story that his buddy was never going to get married, but he invented that as to give a ticking clock into the works, and a structure to the story. And he saw, well, the only way to talk about a sad sack is to do it with humor. The book kicked around for a while. The publishing industry was not the least bit interested, but his agent was also working at the same agency as Alexander Payne's agent. So the book found its way down the hallway and into the stack, and a young man who was reading, an intern was reading material for him, and said, you really should read this novel. So when Alexander went to a Edinburgh Film Festival to show Election, on the way back, he starts reading it on the plane. He gets off the plane at LAX and calls his agent and says, buy this novel. It's my next film. So it wasn't his next film. He made About Schmidt next. And that was such a big film with a big movie star, Jack Nicholson, that he now had the juice to go with a script that he and Jim Taylor wrote to anybody in town and get it made. But he wanted a cast that he wanted, and he wanted very specific conditions. He wanted to shoot out of town for over 50 days, which meant a union crew, and that's very expensive by independent movie standards. But he wanted it in case, because you never know what's going to happen. As it turned out, when he needed sun, there was sun. When he needed darkness, he was dark. Everything went perfectly. It was one of those few shoots that there was nothing that went wrong. And he wanted a cast of character actors and not Hollywood movie stars. In the book, we explore the fact that CAA, or the major agencies, the major agency at the time in Hollywood, had pushed for Brad Pitt and George Clooney to be in those roles. Now, those of you who've seen the film, think of that. That's a different movie.
It's a different movie.
It may be a good movie. Yeah. It may be a funny movie.
Yeah.
But it would be a different movie.
Yeah.
And so he didn't see it that way, and he wanted that cast, and he found one studio, which is then called Fox Searchlight. Since Disney has bought it, it's now just Searchlight Pictures, that was willing to go around. There was an executive there named Peter Rice, but there was also a fellow Greek, because Alexander Payne is a Greek of Greek heritage, and Jim Giannopoulos was the head of the studio at that time. Fox said, yeah, let's make the movie. We believe in your passion for this film. And that's how the film got made.
Oh, okay.
You see that passion in the filmmaking, and over the interviews that we did with Alexander, he explained, he said, it was like a family. The whole cast and crew, they spent weeks before filming in they rented homes in that area. They familiarized with themselves, with the surrounding. And I think the way the film was made, it was just such a camaraderie. That's what comes through on the screen with the audience. They kind of connect to that.
Yeah,
there's a
yeah.
camaraderie, you know.
Ordinary people.
Ordinary people, exactly.
Yeah.
To the point that even in production, he points out little things like to make it ordinary people. He said there was one scene and the costume person was ironing a shirt for one of the characters. He brought an iron shirt and he says, everyday people don't wear iron shirts.
Did you see Miles pack that suitcase?
Yeah, exactly. Boom. This is how people travel.
Threw their clothes in.
And so this is everyday people. They just put on a shirt.
Yeah.
So it related to the audience. That's what, you know, we keep thinking, why the film's longevity? What is the connection? Why do people see it over and over again? There are people we meet at book signings. Somebody says, I've seen it 50 times. Somebody says, I've seen it 100 times.
Wow.
You know, they just, over the time, you know, over 20 years. So I think
it's like an old friend.
Like an old friend, yes.
You know, it kind of feels
so
that way.
It comes through because the filmmaking itself, they were a little family.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Paul Giamatti, who plays Miles and whose career was made by this film, film critics such as myself knew Paul Giamatti. He had been the year before in American Splendor, which won the Best Picture Award in Sundance. But the average person didn't see American Splendor.
Yeah.
So this film made him. And then from that, you know, got John Adams. He says all these things, and none of these things would have happened without Sideways. But Paul Giamatti made the point that Alexander creates an atmosphere on the set whereby you're having this conversation in a back porch about wine, and it's late at night, and, oh, by the way, we're making a movie. In other words, they're not even thinking about the cameras. They're not thinking about all the apparatus of a movie being made. They're having a conversation, and he is able to create that atmosphere, which a lot of directors nowadays, especially the kind of movies they make, can't do, because you're dealing with blue screen and people on wires. And it's just filmmaking has changed so much in 20 years. So I hope this will rediscover how to make these kinds of films. And, you know, there are a lot of filmmakers. Richard Linklater is one. Hitman, I would certainly point to as being a like that kind of film. It's just such a wonderful film and such an odd film. I think is the most like Sideways. It's nothing like Sideways, but in terms of the filmmaking spirit. And Linklater comes out of that same zeitgeist as Alexander Payne. Mm. Symbolically, they're brothers. You know, they believe in the independent film.
Well, your book, Sideways Uncorked, was a joy to read. The way that you wove together a chapter on filmmaking.
Yeah.
It's about the wines. Yeah. A quote in the book about how some people could say that low-budget independent filmmaking is a bit like selling wine.
Yeah, yeah, and it's like making wines, you know, garage wines. Some of these renegade filmmakers, low-budget indie filmmakers, they're exactly like that.
Yeah.
You know, they're making a product that they like, that they want to see, a filmmaker, a winemaker, something that he or she wants to drink, and they go with their own spirit.
Well, thank you so much for joining me. This is Kirk Honeycutt and Mira Advani Honeycutt. The book is Sideways Uncorked, the perfect pairing of film and wine.
And it's available in all the Barnes & Noble stores.
Yes, Amazon.
Thank you for having us. This was delightful.
Thank you both. This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. It's Veterans Day, and there is still time to head to the San Luis Obispo Veterans Memorial Building.
I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from the Veterans History Project Center in San Luis Obispo, and we're here with Bart Topham. How are you, Bart?
I'm good, thank you.
Good. Your official role is?
I'm the director and president of the Veterans Museum here in San Luis. We're starting our 22nd year.
The reason we got together today has to do with Veterans Day.
Yes.
And you're a combat veteran of the Vietnam War.
I am, right? It's part of the reason why I'm here, because I believe in paying it forward.
Talk to us about primary mission of the Veterans Center here.
Well, our primary mission is threefold: to honor, to remember, and to educate. And we have a number of fascinating displays that help honor and remember. We also tell the stories of many of the veterans, particularly Central Coast veterans. And then we have a number of programs where we get together with veterans groups, like we have a Korean War meetup every year, and we used to have a World War II meetup. We also go out, do a lot of outreach programs. We think it's important to educate folks, particularly the younger folks, on what veterans have done for them, and to help them remember, honor, and understand. And so that keeps us really busy. And we think it's relevant because they don't teach this in schools anymore. And a lot of the folks that we deal with have no idea.
Going back in time, both of us were students of World War II history. And right here on the Central Coast, there were some amazing heroes, aviators and whatnot. They were from Arroyo Grande or San Luis.
Yes, absolutely. The Rigetti family, both of their sons, one was a bomber pilot, one was a fighter pilot. We could go on and on. There's a number of fascinating stories.
And like we talked about earlier, war's over, they come home and they go back to the farm or to the pharmacy or whatever.
Yeah, just turned around and went about their business. Mm-hmm. No big fanfare, no big stories. They just came home and went about their business.
And how do you reach out? It's one thing to be like a club or a group of fellow veterans, but the mission is obviously greater than that, reaching out to the community, to the kids, to the schools.
Well, reaching out to veterans is why we host the Veterans History Project in conjunction with the Library of Congress. Mm-hmm. And we try to reach out to every single veteran, no matter what their age, no matter what they did in the military, and we want to record those stories to make it part of the fabric of our country, kind of like a big quilt. And we think it's important to record those stories for posterity. So we're one of the few people in this part of the state that do that. We're very proud of that, and we try to keep that up. And insofar as the public goes, why, we try to do things to reach out to schools, to clubs, to various groups. We'll go anywhere and mm-hmm. talk to anybody, really, but we go to various functions, stand downs, and other groups, open houses, and things like that, to try to spread the word, get people to know. To be honest, it used to really irritate me to have somebody come in that was a local and go, I didn't know you were here. So when I took over, I began a program of trying to raise our profile, and we're still working on that. But I think it's important that everyone, regardless of their age, have at least a basic understanding of what veterans have sacrificed for them.
Mm-hmm. Talk to us a little bit about outreach to the school districts, engaging with kids.
Well, we're not able to do as much as we used to. Pre-COVID, it was pretty steady. But ever since COVID, it's been a little more reluctant. The other thing is, sometimes the schools go, you know, I can't do any more than I'm doing. And I understand that because I was a part-time college teacher for 20 years. And I finally quit doing that because they kept adding to my curriculum without giving me more time. So I get the fact that a lot of teachers have a full plate. Mm-hmm. But there are those that still invite us to come in, and we will go and take measure of the group and try to orient our session with them based on their age and a number of other things that we're looking at to try to help them get an understanding.
Give us a word picture of some of your ongoing live presentations that you do here throughout the year.
We like to do presentations throughout the year periodically. This last Memorial Day, for instance, our theme was the Battle of the Philippines and the Bataan Death March. And we had as a guest speaker, along with his son, a 103-year-old World War II gentleman. He was a survivor of the Bataan Death March, one of the last surviving people from that death march. He survived the invasion and the subsequent battles. He survived the death march. He survived being in a prisoner of war camp for a little over a year, survived a cramped ship voyage from the Philippines to Japan, where he was put into another POW camp and forced to work in the mines for a little over 2 years. And he's quite a gentleman. And another one of those examples, he went through incredible things and just came back and started his life and went on. No complaints, no big stories, just went about his life.
Isn't that incredible?
It is.
And yet those 4 or 5 years was a lifetime plus.
Exactly. Yeah. We really enjoyed having him here, and he gave a couple of talks for us. We put on displays. We created some static displays just for that event. And we tried to do that for both Memorial Day and Veterans Day based on coming up with a theme for each one. For example, this Veterans Day, our theme is the War in the Pacific. And we picked that simply because after some discussions, we decided that there was a lot of people that weren't familiar with the Battle of the Pacific. You know, the European theater got most of the publicity, and yet the whole island-hopping campaign was just unbelievable, and the casualty rates were tremendous. little tiny islands where thousands of U.S. soldiers and Marines perished to take these islands. And we wanted to tell a little bit of that story. So that's the theme for this open house.
As an aside, I interviewed the former commander of the Pacific Fleet, Admiral Thomas Fargo, and we were talking about the European theater of war versus the Pacific. And I always was under the understanding that the death rate in the South Pacific was just astronomical. And he told me that there were more combat deaths in the air over Europe than all the combined Army, Navy, Marine Corps in the South Pacific. Amazing.
It is amazing. And I didn't have any idea until I watched Spielberg's last movie, The Masters of the Air. Mm-hmm. And as it turns out, I have a neighbor whose father was a pilot on one of those bombers and was featured in the movie, in fact. So I enjoyed talking to him, and he, in fact, hosted a special presentation of that movie when it first came out. So, yeah, they had the highest casualty rate.
A lot of the aircraft, it was like a four-hour half-life. It was just crazy. So you knew when you rolled out in the morning, your odds of not coming home today were astronomical, and yet they did it.
They just kept doing it. Yeah. There were flights where a couple of dozen planes would come out and maybe one or two would come back. Mm-hmm. It's these young men, and they were mostly just young men, barely
18,
more than
19,
boys, yes. Yeah. And they just went out and did what had to be done.
Incredible. So closer to home in history, you were a combat veteran in Vietnam on the ground in the Army.
Right. I was in the first CAF. I was a recon team leader. We were a five-man team and would go out in advance of our battalion to scout, collect intelligence in the area of operations that we were slated to go next. Actually, I grew to prefer that kind of work to being attached to, say, a line infantry unit, mm-hmm. because that was even more dangerous, quite frankly.
Yeah.
But, it was interesting. But again, I was 22 years old, and mm-hmm. I was older than a lot of people I was working with.
The old man.
Yeah.
22. So you came home, out.
I came home, and, you know, one of my biggest memories, in fact, I was talking to my brother about this yesterday. I came home after all of that, and everybody acted like I had just come home from college. You know, I mean, it's just, they greeted me, glad to see me, obviously. I come from a close-knit family. But nobody asked any questions. Nobody wanted to talk about it. Nobody wanted to really acknowledge it.
Wow.
And like I said, I came from a loving, close-knit family, and mm-hmm. a lot of folks that didn't have that kind of support probably came back to even worse conditions. But I think it was difficult for the people left behind, for the families, because they knew it was a very controversial time in our country, and the war was very difficult. Mm-hmm. You know, we had some guys that had T-shirts made that had an outline of Vietnam and then a ribbon in the middle that said second place, which told you something about their attitude. Mm-hmm. It was a strange time. It was different.
Moving forward, you now have Iraq and Afghanistan veterans. How do you engage with them here?
Well, we encourage them to come in to talk to us, to participate in one way or another. But it's hard because a lot of them have young families. Mm-hmm. I remember I didn't get involved in a lot of the veterans' activities until after my kids were grown, until I was just about to retire. And a lot of them the same way, because they come home from work and they're immediately going out to take care of family stuff, to watch soccer, baseball, football, that kind of thing. And mm-hmm. they don't feel as if they have a lot of time for the other stuff. But we do try to engage them, offer them any assistance we can, kind of keep in touch, that sort of thing. And mm-hmm. and each era, if you will, is somewhat different and different in their attitudes and approaches and that kind of thing. But like all veterans, most of them don't want to discuss it a lot. Mm-hmm. A lot of them are still processing what they went through.
Yeah, interesting. Before we go, Veterans Day, what again are your...
Well, as I mentioned, our theme this year is the war in the Pacific, and a display talks a lot about that. And then we've created some new static displays. We're reorganizing the museum. And so if you haven't been here in a while, you'll see a lot of different things and different arrangements. Come in and see all there is to see in the museum, and you can take a half an hour, you can take 3 or 4 hours and still not see everything, mm-hmm. especially if you are asking docents to tell you some of the stories.
To learn more about your world, where's your go-to?
Well, there's a couple of things. You can go to our website, which is vetmuseum.org. Okay. That's vetmuseum.org. That's one place to go. Also, we periodically put out some press releases and flyers about various activities and events. In addition to that, we are on Instagram and Facebook. You can find us and get information about things going on Facebook. This is Bart Topham. I'm the director of the Vets Museum here in San Luis Obispo.
Awesome, Bart. Thanks for sharing. And I'm your host, Tom Wilmer. We'll see you here on Veterans Day.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Carol Tangeman, and this is Peace, Love, and Pets. And I have Robin Coleman with me. Welcome, Robin.
Well, hello.
When we first started Peace, Love, and Pets, you were the guest, and today you are the guest again. So November is National Senior Pet Month.
Yes, at Woods, we love celebrating our seniors year-round. It is something that Woods kind of specializes in. A lot of other shelters or rescues hesitate to pull those seniors, thinking maybe they don't have as much value, they are not going to get adopted, they're going to be much more of a cost for that organization. But one thing that I love about Woods is we say yes to those seniors and we see that value. So I particularly love November because every year we get to celebrate our senior pets at Woods. All of November, senior pets, which are 7 and over at Woods.
7 years is considered a senior.
Yeah, so you get a lot of great years still left in those seniors. They just kind of start to mature depending on their breed and size. You know, a cat is pretty much barely out of teenage years at 7. So you get yourself a great deal. But yes, 7 and over at Woods, cats and dogs are fee waived for the entire month. And again, we just really want to spread a little extra love to those seniors. It's hard to see any animal in a shelter, Carol, but seeing a senior pet in a kennel, normally they're a little more sad. They're a little more scared. They have lived in a home by that time. Their world has been flipped upside down. Sometimes our seniors come to us because they lost their owner. Their owner passed away. Their owner got moved into a care facility. Sometimes they're just transfers over. We don't know their background, but usually you can tell by those senior pets, they have lived in a home. They have had a person. They have already got those puppy stages and kitty stages out of the way. Most of them are good with their potty training routines. They just need a little refresher with the new adopter. But we love our senior pets at Woods, and we're going to celebrate them all month long. We make them very comfy at Woods. I know some people come in our cattery and go, your cattery is nicer than my house. I'm not sure if the cat's going to think this is an upgrade or not. But I assure you, it's busy. It's hectic. It's noisy. Strangers coming in and out, medical staff coming and poking and prodding, and all with the best of intentions. But you know, cats, they like uninterrupted naps and just want to find their comfy, cozy place. But more than anything, want a person of their own, someone to love them unconditionally. And you know, we have such great success. I can recall stories of an 18-year-old cat with thyroid issues and this and that. And at another shelter, she would have been euthanized. She just would have not been placed on the adoption floor. At Woods, after we get them to a stable place, we do testing, we do medication, whatever they need. We get them to a healthier spot, and then we do find value in them. And we put them on the adoption floor, and we have waivers, and they can talk to our medical team. And some seniors are perfectly healthy. I'm just giving an example of an 18-year-old cat with thyroid issues.
Yeah.
and thinking, gosh, who's going to adopt an 18-year-old cat? Well, you know what? In this community, someone shows up and adopts that 18-year-old cat, and they send us pictures and updates, and they tell us it was the best decision that they made. And we absolutely love when our senior folks adopt senior pets. That is a big win-win for everybody. Sometimes a senior person with a puppy can be a little too much to take on for both parties. So we absolutely love the idea of senior folks and senior pets. They have kind of similar energy levels. They both still need to be active. They both still need to be on a routine. It's great companionship. Sometimes senior folks, their only companion is their cat or dog in their house with them. So we love that idea as well.
That is a good idea. And I think there's an old saying that just rings true, and that is, it's good to have something to care for.
Oh, it's the best. It's yeah. the best. We came up with 5 reasons why we think people should adopt a senior pet. So I'll share that with you. Cats and dogs can help improve our physical and mental health and reduce depression. By adopting and spending time with an animal friend, you can experience the benefits of lower blood pressure and stress levels. Senior animals are often already trained, and they offer a gentler, calmer companion. And feeling lonely, missing family, cats and dogs provide friendship and encourage opportunities for interacting with others. And of course, senior cats and dogs are the perfect match for someone with a quiet, doting home that just wants to hang out together. I live in Morro Bay, and I see a lot of folks in their routines, and their routines are getting up and walking their dogs and doing their morning stuff and doing their evening stuff.
Good for everyone.
But it really, it's such a social experience as well, because yeah. I know every time I walk my dog, even this morning, 6:30, I'll pass a neighbor, give a wave. Dexter knows all my neighbors.
Dexter is in turn giving you the opportunity for all kinds of human interactions.
Yeah. Oh, how have you been? I haven't seen you recently. Oh, you, how was your trip? Or, you know, whatever the conversation might be, where if we're not out walking our dogs or, you know, sitting on the porch with our kitty cat, we might not have some of those interactions.
Yeah,
so
I do. I interact more with people walking around my neighborhood with the dog. I sometimes think I say hello to the dog, who's a good boy. I'll say that to the dog. Oftentimes we'll start at least a smile, yes. a hello, or a conversation.
I always say in advance, sorry, I remember the name of your dog, but I forgot your name.
I know, right? If you're just joining us, this is Issues and Ideas. I'm Carol Tangeman. My guest today is actually our usual host of Peace, Love, and Pets, Robin Coleman. So one thing I know people sometimes have a concern with a senior pet is that they know that the day that they will need to say goodbye to that pet, you know, I mean, it's going to be sooner than if they adopt, you know, a kitten or a puppy.
Mm-hmm. Sure. And I think there's benefits to that. Some people, they're not sure where they're going to be in 10 years. They're not sure if they're going to where they're going to be in 5 years or 15 years. So I think sometimes a shorter commitment works better for people where they're at in their lives. And also just what a beautiful gift it is. And we definitely do hear people coming in and think they're doing something really sweet for that sweet senior, that animal. But so quickly does that turn around, and we are getting the thank yous, and we are getting the, I had no idea what this pet was going to bring into my life. And you know, Carol, earlier this year, I was one of those people that decided to say yes to a senior pet.
And that little guy was quite a senior. You brought him in. Like you were holding him.
He was like a dinosaur.
He was like a little dinosaur.
So I've been at Woods almost 11 years now.
Yeah.
And I had started my journey when I had adopted my Dexter. And he is approaching 13.
And he's big. So
he's a big, mastiff boy. So I have been dealing with anticipatory grief a bit. And I know I'm going to be in a pretty tough spot when I have to say goodbye to my Dexter. But I made it almost a decade at Woods, just devoting myself to Woods, the animals there, and then getting home to Dexter. But earlier this year, I fell in love with a little guy named Timo. But this little guy came into Woods. He was picked up as a stray in March with scabs all over his body, missing a lot of fur. He was partially blind, partially deaf, you know, really bad health, did yeah. not look good. But again, Woods saw that value, and we found out that he was originally from Woods back in 2009. It was a pretty small mom and pop type feeling in that time. Mm-hmm. And when I found out that as a 2-month-old puppy, he made his way to Woods from a Kern County shelter. Well, yours truly, Robin, also made her way over here from Kern County. I said that we were both lucky enough to find our way to Woods, and little Timo was lucky enough to find his way not once, but twice. So 2 months he found his way to Woods, the luckiest thing that ever happened to him. And then at 15 years old, he was found as a blind and deaf stray. Mm. So we extracted, I think, 13 teeth from that little guy.
Oh, wow.
And he needed a little place to go after his dental procedure. And of course, they were like, Robin, can he come hang out in your office for a few hours? We don't want to put him back in the kennel. I said, oh, my gosh, of course. But when I took him into my arms and I held him while I was working, I could tell he was a special soul. He seemed a bit broken. And of course, it came time to leave work that day. And I said, I can't put this dog in his kennel. You know what? I'm just going to take him home with me tonight. You know, it's one night.
One night.
I've done that many of times.
Yeah.
But fast forward, I kept him for a few days so he could heal. And I started to see these little similarities between Dexter and him. I would find them laying next to each other in the same position. And Dexter is someone who doesn't really like to share mom. So I found this a little odd that he was so agreeable to welcoming Timo into our home for a few days. And after Dexter accepted him so well, I fell in love with little Timo. Even in a few days, I could see like he wanted to be on my lap a little bit. And I was not looking for another dog. I had a very strong calling that I was supposed to give this little guy his last chapter. And I adopted little Timo. And again, he was over 15, partially deaf, partially blind, bad skin, bad teeth. You will never be lost. You will never be stray. You will never be alone. You are going to be loved for the rest of your days. Oh. And I didn't know how long that was going to be. I thought maybe a year or so. And unfortunately, it was only just over 3 months. So it was so fun to just spoil this little guy. Most of his hair grew back. I started to see his personality. He started to have all the same routines that Dexter had. Dexter showed him all the ropes, just wrapped me around their little paws. But it was so fun and such a great experience. And of course, yes, heartbreaking. I didn't expect to have to say goodbye so soon. But I did exactly what I set out to do. And I can tell you, he went from a broken dog to a fully healed and happy and loved dog. He just went into failure. And within 2 days, you know, I said goodbye to him. I took him for one last van ride and, you know, little extra treat and did all the things that I love to do when it's the end of a dog's or cat's life. But my little Timo was only with me for a few months, but that's a great story of a senior pet. Yes, I took a risk. My heart got broken. I cried for a few weeks and missed him around the house and looked for him and all those things that we do when we have to say goodbye. But what a great ending to a little life like Timo. But that was a senior pet that wiggled his way into my heart this year.
And I hope
that maybe we'll make somebody else say yes to that senior. You know, again, we think we're doing it for them. And I do feel like I did it for him. But I did get so much out of it in return. And I think that's what's so wonderful about adopting any shelter animal.
Yeah. And that grieving experience, you know, there's going to be sadness.
I think pet loss is something that we don't talk about enough, that we don't have enough support for. Our pets are such a big part of our lives, our family, like we talked about, our day-to-day schedules, our routines. So when they do leave us, it leaves a very big void. And I think it's something that some people are open to talk about, and some people think it's just a cat or dog. I can't cry. I can't be sad. And that is not the case. They are parts of our family. And our pets love us truly, unconditionally. And doesn't that feel so good? That is why we love that pet love so much. So it's something I'm passionate about. I pick up the phone every day at Woods and get 5 or 6 calls from people who unfortunately have lost a pet. They had to say goodbye. They have items that they no longer, you know, want to look at or want it to go to a good purpose. And so I talk to 5 to 10 people a day sometimes that have just said goodbye to a pet. So it's something that's in my conversation almost daily. And I studied it and I've learned it. And that's why I became an animal Reiki practitioner. I think end of life for pets doesn't have to be something tragic, something emergency, something not prepared and planned. These days we have mobile, options. We have at-home euthanasia. We really can have more kind of ceremony if you want it. Some people are fine not, but I think sometimes a special relationship with a spirit dog or a spirit cat or a soulmate, it deserves a end of life celebration in a way. So yeah. I'm a proponent of that. And also this time of year, I'm so happy to be a part of, again, the last few years, Hospice of Slo County, which is a great organization. And they have a pet peace of mind program that I'm a big fan of as well. But every year they do their Light Up a Life ceremony, and you can do that for humans. But one date out of their year, they also do a pet remembrance ceremony. And they have singers that kick off the little celebration. You make a donation to their organization, and that helps support their pet peace of mind program. We will read the pet's name at the ceremony, so you can come or you can not come. That's your choice. We also do a little candlelight ceremony. We have a few speakers. And then this year, we are moving it out to Woods because we have outgrown the hospice little lobby there. So we are hosting it out at Woods out in San Luis. So we have much more space to welcome people.
What a good idea.
I know. And I've been wanting to do pet loss support groups for so long. So I hope this is going to be the start of something like that. Me coming to this event the last few years and being able to speak at it, it does feel a bit like a support group. You're around like-minded people that are going through similar things. And some of these pets passed away 15 years ago, and some of these pets passed away this year. So you can be at all different stages of grief. You know, grief doesn't always leave us. It just kind of pops up here and there or looks a little bit differently as time goes by. But this year, it's going to be on Thursday, November 14th. And we're going to do from 5 to 6, some refreshments and some resources. And this could be something that you think you may be losing a pet at some point. It doesn't have to be a pet that you've already lost. Maybe you want to kind of get some support before, or you know it's coming up. And then from 6 to 7 will be the actual reading of the names. They have their singers come in and start the ceremony. We do our reading of the names. We do our lighting ceremony. And then this year, we're going to end with a little sound bath, which is the most wonderful, healing, calming, meditative type thing where you can just reflect for a few moments. So this is also a great thing to do if you have a friend or family who has lost a pet and you know are struggling. You could do this and you get a commemorative little thing you could put on your tree or send to them, a little ornament, they call it. But you can check out more on our website, our woodshumane.org, our events calendar. It's up there now. We'll be posting on social media, but we still have time to submit some names. It's a great gift and just a great thing to do and to let somebody know that you're thinking of them. So I'm excited for this event, even though it's a serious topic. I think it's something that we really do need as a community.
I think so too. So it's Thursday, November 14th at Woods Humane Society.
Yeah, woodshumane.org. And there is a whole events calendar and okay. You'll be able to find the link there. And then of course, Hospice of Slo has their own website as well. And then don't forget, senior pets rock all month long at Woods. So it's all about our seniors. And again, a little pause to remember ceremony for any of us that have or will be losing a pet and need a little bit of support. It's a really sweet, supportive event.
Okay, well, thank you so much for this, Robin. That's Robin Coleman of Woods Humane Society, our host of Peace, Love, and Pets. You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about